The Dogs of War podcast is brought to you by Fansided. Party on, Raleigh, and party on, Kevin.
Hey! Dogs of War! Dogs of War! Podcast! Cleveland Browns!
It's the offseason. It's time to talk Brown stuff with your excellent co-host, Raleigh. And with him, as always, is equally excellent co-host, Kevin. Browns confirmed, Raleigh. And Browns confirmed, Kevin.
Dogs of War!
And you ready?
Oh, yeah. I was born ready. After a two-week hiatus, we're back, baby.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Dogs of War podcast. If you're listening to this the day it's coming out, it is Thursday, July 8th. We've been off for a couple of weeks. To be frank, not a whole lot to talk about with the Browns in July, which is actually going to be tough to say here because our very, very special guest today has to do this many, many times a week and for 4 hours every single day. Raleigh, would you like to bring in our esteemed guest who must have lost a bet or something to be on this podcast today, but nonetheless, we appreciate it.
We've been hounding him for some time. Can't believe we did it. This is Mel Gibson caliber interview. Let's go. We got Mr. Mike Ryan Ruiz, the executive producer of the Dan Lebatard Show, and more importantly, diehard Browns fans. First question, did you grow up in Miami?
Yeah, grew up in Miami. So I imagine you could ask me how I became a Browns fan, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's a very Miami story, actually. My grandparents were Cuban exiles. My dad was a Cuban exile. So by being a Cuban exile, you leave the country, you leave your wealth, your home, you leave everything behind, and you come to the United States with nothing. So my family in Cuba was upper middle class, but here, you know, bare bones poor. So they had to build themselves up from zero. And that meant a life of poverty for my grandparents and my father for quite a while. They had good jobs there, and my grandmother had to work in hotels down here as a cleaning lady because that was the only job that she could get down here in Miami. Long story short, because of that poverty, she would shop at the dollar store, and this was a habit that was fortified over decades by the time I came around, and there is a high concentrated Cuban area of Miami called Hialeah, in which she lived, and there was a Hialeah dollar store, and through whatever random avenues Brown's memorabilia might find its way to the Hialeah dollar store, it did, and I was there, and I love sports, and anything with a helmet or a logo on it, I gravitated to. She would shop there for just regular household items. She would make a great bistec empanizado, which is just basically breaded steak. It's awesome. Whenever I would go there on the weekends, because she shopped at the random Hialeah dollar store, all her paper plates and napkins and cups were Cleveland Browns themed. Huh. Yeah. And
as if her life wasn't already challenging enough.
Like, yeah. So after a couple of years of eating off of these ugly orange helmet plates that I didn't really know. I just thought it was like a generic football plate. The Dolphins were playing the Browns when I was very young on TV, and I put two and two together, and I found my team. And then that team left, and it was terrible for two decades when they came back. And I often shake a fist towards the heaven that the Hialeah dollar store didn't have Patriots paper plates. I stuck with the Browns. I never followed them to Baltimore. I guess for those few years that there wasn't a football team, I leaned Dolphins. But the second it was announced that the Browns were back, I was a very happy kid. And I've lived and died with this team. More deaths over the years. More deaths. A lot more deaths. But, yeah, I love them because they randomly found their memorabilia into a Hialeah dollar store.
I don't know if it was rent. Do you ever reflect?
That's amazing.
Do you ever reflect on the guy that was like, "Yeah, I'm going to get rid of these Browns helmets, give them to the dollar store, and shape the life of this guy."
It's a butterfly effect. Every cause has a reaction to it, and I don't know what possessed whoever was taking inventory at the Hialeah dollar store to take in paper plates of the Cleveland Browns, but I'm sure happy they did because it's a fan base unlike any other, and we all kind of identify with this for lack of a better word, loser mentality, and the passion for the team never really went away. It's sort of like a badge of honor that we're able to suffer through that and still have packed stadiums and still travel as well as we have. And I'm kind of curious now what it's going to be like for us on the road, because generally whenever I would travel to Browns games, people were always super nice and kind of felt bad for us. Yeah. And I'm going to the Kansas City game, and I'm genuinely curious to see what the reaction is going to be to us now.
Oh yeah. I got my, do you got your flights yet for that, Kevin?
No, for October.
Yeah. No, for Kansas City.
It's September.
Oh no. I decided to not go to Kansas City for the first game.
No.
Cause we have potentially two games in LA this year. So I'm trying to put my, you know, my money, my PTO where it should be, just in case. You got to hold it in. Mike, that story is incredible. And now let me just preface this by saying I am in no way comparing Clevelanders to immigrating from Cuba and having to work 1,000 hours a day. Like, let's get that straight. But the fact that your grandma was one of those badass, you know, working 22 hours a day, probably walking to and from all this, like you said, cleaning, that's such a very much of the blue collar Cleveland mentality too. That so many people in Cleveland, especially people that listen to us, like take pride in. So that still is a very, very interesting parallel. And it makes sense.
Somehow or another, we always
find our way of some similarities here.
Yeah. Well, the Browns, as much as they gravitate towards their reputation, they also really embrace the blue collar Rust Belt heartland of it all, which is, you couldn't really get further away from that down here in Miami. But it's an interesting dichotomy for me. It's my favorite professional sports team. And I say that as someone that's on the payroll of Chelsea FC. This is the Cleveland Browns winning would mean everything to me. Making Ben Roethlisberger cry was honestly one of the happiest moments of my life. And I love everything that goes into it, and this team deserves a winner. The city, Cleveland, and their fan base in particular really deserve a winner.
So on your show, one of my buddies who listens to the Le Batard show all the time wanted to know if Stugatz is genuine in when he says he's happy for Browns fans.
I don't think could have stopped it. You could have stopped it at genuine. Stugatz is not genuine, really.
You heard it here first.
Yeah, Stugatz is his character on the air is a very slight amplification of who he is in real life. Everyone else has to amplify their personalities by just very means of being on the show. But Stugatz is as close to real as you'll find, and it's honestly the most honest, truthful relationship I have, because I just approach everything that he says as this is a lie. So if you do that, you kind of get to see in the matrix. You know the truth at the heart of everything. If you just know that everything that comes out of this human being is a lie,
Kevin, don't act like you've seen the Matrix.
I haven't seen the Matrix.
I got the reference. That was sick. So. The executive producer of one of the most listened to sports podcasts in the world.
Podcasts.
What did I say?
Sports podcasts, but fair.
Yeah.
You're not wrong, but I'm just extending that.
Yeah, and you're also wrong to call into question whether or not we're a sports podcast, Kevin.
The Clevelander Hotel, is that where all the episodes are recorded?
Yeah, we still have that studio. We obviously had a very well-publicized breakup with ESPN, but in the negotiations, that piece of real estate is presently ours.
And was that your hill? Was that your fight? Was that the EVP flexing, saying, no, guys, it's going to be the Clevelander Hotel?
No, happy coincidence. I've spotted the irony in that. I think the most ironic thing of all is we probably don't get that studio built within that Clevelander hotel were not for LeBron James leaving Cleveland. So I think that's actually the truer ironic meaning behind us being at the Clevelander is LeBron coming to Miami, making that decision that I'm sure you guys felt painfully, because I felt it when he decided to go back there. I can't even imagine what it must have been like the first time he built us an economy. It was probably, economically speaking, the most impactful sports thing that ever happened to us.
ironically, our economy at the time was pretty much entirely based on LeBron. So
yeah,
4-1 Miami. I guess the yachts. You're saying the yachts that you already had
in Miami. I will say my own personal sports economy down here in South Florida changed from that moment on.
You talked about it. You said the well-publicized. So in December, it was announced that you guys at ESPN will be parting ways. You guys had your final show the first week of January this year. You guys signed with DraftKings, you know, a few months later. You guys have had what seems to be, like, from the cheap seats where Raleigh and I sit, you guys have had a hell of a last 6-7 months. He's kind of walk us through, like, this whirlwind, and are your guys' heads still spinning? Is it like we're cool back, we're calm back down again, and things just like cruising? Like, you guys did this huge transition, but you're still one of the biggest podcasts on the planet. I mean, that's no surprise. Your fans aren't going to just disappear. But yeah, I just want to hear about these last few months. It's just been incredible to watch you guys.
Thank you so much. And I'm going to be very careful to not turn this into a therapy session, because it has been very hard. And I think people kind of take for granted how hard it is to build. It's not sexy, but building an infrastructure is taxing. We were the hood ornament on a startup company. Startup companies are notoriously very difficult. A lot of them go under, and not a lot of them have what Metal Arc had in us, which was a wildly popular sports property. And so to the audience sitting at home, when they get their podcast and their workflow in terms of enjoying the content we put out doesn't change all that much, they assume everything is just the same as it ever was. And no, January 4th, ESPN ripped out all their equipment. We had 12 hours. We had some weeks in lead time in making sure software was right, but we had basically 12 hours to put in an all-new infrastructure. And we worked tirelessly throughout the holidays to make sure that we were ready to give our audience what they craved, which was the Levitard show as they always experience it, which was primarily a podcast. So TV cameras go away. But when we say, all right, let's do a show on January 5th, no one cares to really bring up, like, all right, internet. How are we going to do that? Because I log in on this computer and it's a Disney Corp login. How are we going to have internet? Yeah. How are we going to have bandwidth? How are we going to do the show? So we had to figure all that stuff out. Engineering is not a foreign language to me just by being in the industry for about 20 years. But when we're like, I was out of my depth. So we brought in two assassins in Alex Tyner and Chris Whittingham. When I was asked by Metal Arc very early on, like, what do you need to get this done? I was like, give me that guy, and we'll roll and we'll figure it out. So it was very difficult early on. I am very proud to say that after the first couple of weeks, we decided to reduce our output to 3 shows a week. We actually increased our listenership from what it was over at ESPN when we were doing 5 shows a week. So we are now perennially in that top 3 sports podcasts, and it's basically musical chairs between Bill Simmons, Part of My Take, and us. We, the DraftKings thing was a lot of hard work, a lot of presentations, a lot of strategizing, a lot of great people coming together to make that thing happen, and it worked out. We bet on ourselves, and I can tell you, while we were very happy at ESPN, and it was great for our careers, it wasn't 3 years, $50 million. So I feel like it was a good bet on us, and it worked out well. We've taken that money and we're putting it back into the company and eventually hiring more talent and doing more creative endeavors outside of just what you've seen with the Levitard Show. And even with the Levitard Show, we did that Freedom Marathon, which damn near killed me.
Where I wanted to go next. So great segue, but yeah, sorry, keep going.
We did that Freedom Marathon, and I can answer your questions on that. But yeah, it damn near killed me. And really, I burned out, to be honest with you. I needed 3 weeks off. I had nothing left after that marathon. And what it was wasn't just so much that marathon. Though the marathon was very, very hard, professionally speaking. It was the most ambitious thing we've ever done, and there was a sense of accomplishment. But really, it was the infrastructure. It was leaving ESPN. And prior to that, it was doing 8 months of shows from Dan's apartment, being the only person to engineer and literally moving headphones to computer screens and figuring out how to integrate and inventing, really, because no one had figured it out, how to get Zoom quality audio from people on remote broadcasts that don't have ISDN machines to sound top quality on the radio. We invented that. I invented that with Chris Whittingham. We rigged a whole piece of equipment to sound good, and was just doing that stuff by myself. It was a pandemic transition and marathon that just ended up killing me. It was a very rough year and a half, and the result is 3 years, $50 million with DraftKings and a really good partner that believes in what we do and the opportunity to create even more cool content.
That's so incredible. Speaking of wealth and power, we got to jump. Do we have an ad read this week, Kevin?
No, we do not.
We're poor again. Never mind. Continue.
For people that, we're taking June and July. We're off months for the ad reads there, Rally. For people that are living under a rock or under the 480 bridge, as always, shout out to them. What Mike was just discussing here is called freedom. The 24-hour, I even know, like, what's a word to describe this? Extravaganza, bonanza, radiopalooza.
Yeah, radiopalooza is probably the best way to describe it because it wasn't a marathon. Other shows, and this is not a knock on them, other shows have done like 24 hours, and it's crazy. It actually seems like a mental health minefield because they lock themselves in one room, and it usually devolves into like, let's just drink a bunch of beer and eat a lot of food and watch the game and interact with people. And we wanted to really schedule this thing out. So it was, a rotation of guests every 15 minutes. Every 15-minute block was thoroughly planned over the course of 2 months. And that's not typically how we roll. We typically fly by the seat of our pants, but we wanted to spotlight all of our podcast properties. And it was really a festival for fans of the show. And I really am proud of what we accomplished there. It's living on our Levitard and Friends YouTube page. If you haven't seen it, it's fairly evergreen. And yeah, it almost killed me.
So this was the big way to kick off the DraftKings partnership. Again, explain to our listeners who may have missed it. And I know a lot of them listen to you guys. You guys had Pat Riley, Barkley, Rome.
Yeah.
I mean, you talk about all the heavy hitters. I mean, I can't really think of a better way to kick off a new partnership/ kind of a new, path that you guys are going down, or new journey, if you will, with Skipper. I wanted just to hear more about just planning 24 hours of radio podcasting of guests. It just sounds absolutely daunting and dizzy just thinking about it, but you guys pulled it off and killed it.
We brought in this really brilliant young man named Carl Scott from the Players Tribune, and he really formatted an organizational template that I think our team really needed. And we just spent months on end planning this thing out, getting with people, making sure that we weren't double booked. Obviously, with a 24-hour marathon, you're going to have some fluidity. Things are going to fall through the cracks. But everything from the big beginning where a marching band shows up with Stu Gatz, we wanted to start in the tiny broom closet and kind of trick the viewer into thinking that, oh, this is just them in the room for 24 hours. And great, we're going to be really happy. But then we wanted to show the scope of everything. We have cameras on the roof. We had cameras on the street. We have live music. So we programmed all those things. We booked all those things. We found a way to do it. We invented a lot of things along the way. And I'm immensely proud. We thought we were going to have a big, important playoff game. And we kind of didn't. Kawhi versus Luka wasn't, it was a cool game in retrospect, but we were expecting, a Knicks game or a game of severe consequence. I believe that was a game six. And so it just turned into who's going to eat the spiciest pepper on the planet. And there were a bunch of like shock jock things in there too. But I stayed up for all 24 hours. I produced all 24 hours. I was dead. I was feeling accomplished, but I was so burnt out from the previous year and a half that I don't really think I got to enjoy it. This is probably the most I've enjoyed the after effects of it in retrospect, because I'm not too close to it anymore. But yeah, it beat me into the ground. But like I said, you can pull up the video on YouTube and literally scan to any day part, whether it's 4 a.m. and the brilliant sort of public access parody that Greg Cody did. And you'll find something that was programmed top to bottom, outside of stupidity, because Stu Gatz definitely mailed that one in.
That's the best thing about this, is that you can it's 24 hours long, but you can really just play Rush, just click anywhere in it, and you use the word evergreen, and it's I mean, you guys, not, I mean, it's incredible. I mean, I we talk about Raleigh and I, you know, in the off season, sometimes we'll take a couple weeks off because we don't want to go on and just ramble about nothing and have that awkward silence of podcasts that no one likes and gets real creeped out by. You guys don't have that option. Because you guys have developed your podcast and built it up to being one of the biggest in the world. And you guys not only don't have that option, you can't 24 straight hours of programming and producing. A lot of people don't understand. I don't understand the depth and the just the scope of all of that.
Yeah, it's not just producing, and it's not just producing audio. It's not just producing my talent. It's not just feeding them and directing them in their headphones, because the bulk of what I do isn't really known to the listener because it's all through back channels, but it's also producing television at the exact same time. I would be on the air contributing on the air while I have a director in Kansas City speaking in my ear about where we're going to go to next. I back channel with him, tell him exactly what I'm setting up. It was a lot. I had one person put on my headphones for a 10-second stretch, and this is a person that has hosted Outside the Lines before, and she just threw my headphones off because I was living in a maniac's world. It was a lot. It was a lot, but it was really cool. The end product, our fans really loved it, outside of the fact that it was 23 hours and 50 minutes, and I haven't heard the end of it.
The unsung hero that just described this whirlwind of chaos that was well executed. On top of all that, you have a young kid, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. That was my first. Yeah, that's my firstborn. And honestly, the last year and a half, I couldn't have done without my support system here, because people ask me how I did it, and I would kind of deadpan to them. I kind of feel like I'm a bad husband and father because I'm just consumed by work, and I really need, like, I lean on my wife to really help out. And we all kind of understood that it would be a down payment on our future this last year and a half, and it was, and it still is. But yeah, she's an absolute hero. As after freedom, I'm like, I'm taking 3 weeks off. We're going to California, and it's just us. And we did that, and thank God we all kind of collectively wore the last year and a half of content on our sleeves. So it was good to actually spend every waking moment with my daughter and see what I miss, and make me realize that I'm never going to get to the point where I'm just inundated and I get burned out. I was aware that what I was doing in the moment was crazy, right? But awareness and actually acting upon that awareness are two different things. And I very much treated the Freedom Marathon as like a finish line. Let me just crawl over this finish line and let me just get there. So I push a lot of things onto my plate that I probably should have said no to in retrospect. And now, through family and a decompression period and seeing my beautiful daughter's face while we were in Malibu, I realized things are going to change, and I'm not going to kill myself in the name of content anymore.
Did you take any time in the 3 weeks that you were out there to just kind of sit back and reflect and appreciate of how much you guys have done and accomplished in the last like 6 months?
You know, this is the most that I have. It is pretty
cool. Like, have you ever taken 3 weeks off before?
No.
No. Yeah.
It took 2 weeks off when I got married. I mean, the pandemic made taking time off very difficult. my options were limited too. So it was also a byproduct of everything that the pandemic brought on. But yeah, 2 weeks in California and 1 week just to recover, I guess, because I legitimately burned out. No, I'm going to do a better job of that, which is why I'm going to Kansas City. It's why I'm going to Cleveland when they play the Broncos on Thursday Night Football. When everything started opening up and you realize that when we got our vaccine, I'm like, this is, we can live our life. We got some living to catch up on. Mm-hmm. So I am traveling a lot in the next few months.
And he owes all of that mental toughness from the guy that dropped off the Browns plates at the dollar store.
That's right.
That's a thing of beauty. That's not. Uh-huh. I don't know if that's actually true, but it's a Browns podcast. We should probably talk about some Browns stuff as time is a-wasting. So this off season, no drama. It's bizarre. Yeah. We're like, it's a struggle when you're trying to put up Browns content, but it's also like, well, we're obviously homers, Browns fans. Mm-hmm. So it's like not having to talk about a marijuana related offense is fantastic.
No guns.
Knock on wood. Just yet.
Big knock on wood. Big knock on wood.
We got 3 weeks till camp, right? So come on.
one of the greatest lines ever, as far as Browns analysis goes, was on your show when you said to Dan, Baker's got the good dudes. Baker's yeah. got the goods, dude.
Yeah, you can buy that shirt on levitardaf.chat. He's got the goods, great dude.
Plug. That is a sick plug.
Yeah, I think there's actually plenty to talk about, but you guys have probably already addressed it ad nauseum. Baker's flatly a different quarterback when Odell Beckham Jr. is out there on the field. As great as Baker was to close that season, you kind of have to pay attention to the fact that he became a different quarterback the second Odell got hurt. The best we've seen of Baker as a pro has been with Odell off. So how does Odell change his game coming off of that injury? How does that affect Baker? Baker's a guy that really likes to spread the pill around, and he was very clearly forcing it to Odell Beckham Jr., and that made him less accurate. Now, you could probably place a lot of the blame on his struggles earlier in the season on the fact that, hey, new system.
Pandemic,
a whole remote training camp, all that stuff. And the more comfortable that quarterbacks get within that system, the better they perform. We've seen it with Stefanski before. So you could put it on that, or you could look at what is now becoming a representative sample of basically half of Baker's career. He's damn near an all-pro when he doesn't have Odell Beckham Jr. on the field. So I think we have a very limited preseason, and I don't know exactly how they're going to work in Odell off of that injury. It seems like he's ready to go. I'm very curious to see what they do on the field together, the emergence of Peoples Jones, and will Baker continue to spread the ball around? I think our tight end position is fascinating. And Njoku, I thought, closed the season as our best tight end. He really recommitted himself to blocking in a way that I haven't. I've loved David Njoku. I'm a Miami Hurricane season ticket holder. I have never seen Njoku block like he was towards the end of the season. Is that the player that is coming back? Because, you know, if you have to worry about anybody in an offseason, you worry about Odell and you worry about Njoku because they like to have their fun. So far, so good. Knock on wood. How committed is David Njoku to being the player that he was there? Do you pay Baker? Do you play Nick Chubb? I kind of find those conversations not as interesting as how do these pieces fit with inside the offense. I think the Odell thing is going to define this season. And I think we're starting to get a pretty representative sample that if it's not working, as much as I love Odell, as much as there is a place for Odell in this offense, because this offense is about exploiting mismatches. And we saw towards the tail end of the season against Kansas City in the playoff game how Odell could have really helped. It just put the ball in his hands. We saw it in the win against Dallas when they didn't really have much and they were still figuring out their identity. Just give it to Odell and he'll make something special happen. He's a dynamic player and I really want to make it work with him. But if it's not working in the earlier season, does a front office decide to make a move and not try to stress this thing out as they got a quarterback that they have to continue to develop? And obviously on the defensive side of the ball, Chad Henne turned the corner on our linebackers. That can't ever happen again. it can never happen. The opportunity was there. It was as simple as making sure Chad Henne wouldn't turn the corner. And our linebackers, who have been ignored largely because of the analytics-based front office and ignoring that position. Wow, I'm just hosting this podcast now. Welcome.
No, this is great.
that was the wish, the hope. Yes.
Yeah.
What you're saying about Baker, he's spreading the ball around when he's a better quarterback with Odell on or off the field. That's been kind of one of the debates amongst fans. Baker publicly said it wasn't Odell's presence or lack thereof. He attributed the success to the bye week. That was like the first time where we could kind of sit down and regroup. I mean, they had virtually no preseason. They have a new head coach, a new system. I like to think that we always defer to Stefanski. We're like, well, they're smarter than us and they actually call the shots. I think with time to develop with Odell in this new season, I think they are going to have, I don't know if it's a short leash, but they're asking themselves the same questions. And if it doesn't work, I think they're going to pull the plug, but they're going to give them the shots. And right now, I don't know. But that being said, it's almost counter to Baker when Odell went down in that Bengals game. He threw like 20 straight completions in a row. It's like, well, that wasn't a bye week. That was the second half of the second half of the game. So who knows, man? But oh my God, it gives me jingles. I'm back. Yeah. I'm all in.
Yeah, it's an exciting time. These are good problems to have. Like, we know we have a quarterback, where for 21 years we were asking, do we have a quarterback? I kind of feel like we're all relatively confident now that we've seen him do it. We've seen him do it in big games. We've seen him do it for huge chunks of the season when his team really needs him. Now it's, how can we help the quarterback? Do we have the right around him, not just offensively, but defensively? Because I felt like the defense with a, it all crescendoed in that one moment with Chad Henne turning the corners on our linebackers. And quite honestly, it's an echo chamber probably, but Myles Garrett was not himself towards the end of the season.
No.
70% of Myles Garrett is still better than most players, but it's still not 100% of Myles Garrett. And he could have really impacted the game if he were 100%. And now you have Clowney opposite of him. And yeah, you can't help but get super excited. The additions in the secondary also get me very excited. And I think Cleveland has a very tried and true contender here to push for that elusive Super Bowl appearance that generations have gone without seeing.
Here's a fun question, and I love this question because it just seems like all of the answers are positives. Last year, we had to you could count on literally three fingers who the best defensive player is or whatever on a team that struggled defensively. Which new addition defensively, which player are you most excited for?
Well, this one's not going to be sexy, but Clowney he's always been a confusing player. With the release times of quarterbacks these days, his sack totals really haven't been what everybody would expect them to be, but he still impacts the game. So he's kind of like this really interesting case study for analytics dorks. And I've gone to Sloan MIT, and I'd like to delve into those numbers. And I'm really curious to see what the combination of those two guys, exactly how they complement each other as pass rushers and as run stoppers too, because they could impact the game there. I am really curious to see how this plays out, because I happen to think this is going to go well. Clowney said, which I thought was really jarring considering, I didn't know if to read into it that he just didn't like J.J. Watt or if he was just really transparently honest about what he felt about Myles Garrett, but he said he's never been paired with someone like Myles Garrett. And this is a guy that played alongside J.J. Watt, one of the greatest pass rushers in the history of the NFL. So I think if you get pressure with four or three, you can really alleviate a lot of the issues that you saw in that secondary, a lot of the issues that you saw with those linebackers. And towards the end of the season, Myles was hit or miss with how COVID impacted him. We finally saw some production from our D-line that wasn't Myles Garrett towards the end of the season, but injuries impacted our pass rushers there. So I think that this could be a big cure-all and a big cover-up for a lot of our deficiencies along that back seven. So I really want to see how our D-line, without Sheldon Richardson and with the addition of Clowney, can really get after the quarterback and make lives easier for our young cornerbacks that I think are going to start to come online. And hopefully Greedy is a part of that.
I don't care who you are. If you're Mahomes, if you're a first-year rookie, if you've been in the Tom Brady, looking over and seeing Myles Garrett and Clowney lining up, yeah, and their one goal is to get to your head, not in the literal sense, like they're just to you, is, I mean, that's just something else. Another question I wanted to ask you, to piggyback off of Raleigh's question, your favorite new addition, who was your favorite or most intrigued draft pick?
Who's the kid that we got from Auburn that's the fastest player?
Schwartz?
Schwartz. Yeah. Sorry, I blanked
out
on his
name. Already the fastest player in the NFL?
Yeah.
Supposedly. I don't know. Like, let's see him in a game, but yeah.
On paper, he's the fastest player in the NFL. He ran a 4.25.
Yeah, speed.
Like he'd be at the Olympics this summer if he wasn't playing football.
Yeah, like you said, our default is we trust Stefanski to exploit the mismatches, right? And when you have the fastest player in the NFL and you have a quarterback that could throw it over the mountains, I want to see what that looks like. And then you could use Odell in more short field situations, really just put the ball in his hand quickly. I think the biggest issue with Baker, because Mina Kimes is a friend, and we've talked about this ad nauseum. She probably prefers I don't talk about it as much as I do. But I think no one would say that Eli Manning of 3 years ago was better than Baker Mayfield was last year, right? But he found a way to get the ball to Odell. He found a way to maximize Odell. Odell would tell you that he was still frustrated about how he was using the offense. But when you think about Eli throwing it to Odell, what do you think about? Because I think about the quick screen. A quick screen over the line to Odell Beckham Jr., and then Odell takes it and runs 17 yards with it, shaking somebody, running out off to the sideline. Yeah, you have the highlight catch down deep in the end zone. But really, how they implemented Odell was really quick passes, and Odell would do damage with the yak. I think Baker's height is often ignored when it comes to that. We're not able to utilize that one play because Baker can't necessarily get it over the line from a standing position. Eli's tall enough where he's said, "Hut," throws it over the line into the hands of Odell quickly. Baker's got to move out of the pocket to be able to deliver that ball, and by the time that happens, Odell's not open anymore, and then you're forced to try to make things happen, and you have two guys improvising and ignoring other reads. So if they can get Odell into the slot in places where you have Schwartz cutting off and you have that as, essentially as a decoy that you keep the defense honest on a couple of times, and those times will be sensational because they'll be 80-yard bombs, then you could really implement Odell Beckham Jr. the way that I think he's best utilized, which is doing damage in the slot, real quick passes. You have a tired defense. Nick Chubb's been beating you to death for three quarters, and now we got to worry about the shiftiness and speed of Odell Beckham Jr. That, to me, is a killer recipe for success towards the end of the season. And
it's arousing.
Yeah, and I think Schwartz cutting off the top of the defense is key. Once Baker knows that he can peel off of that read to Odell real quick and go to Schwartz and keep that defense honest, it's game over for me.
Do you agree with, and if so, why do you think that the goalposts keep moving further and further back for Baker? You know, last year, 2 years ago, can he just be a competent quarterback? Can he be assistant? Now it's, why isn't he Mahomes? Yeah. The standards people keep holding him to on certain TV programs or radio shows keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and no other quarterback in the league has that on him.
No other quarterback in the league really talked as brashly as Baker did when he entered the league, and no other quarterback in the league talked as brashly without necessarily proving it on the field as much and still was a part of every commercial that you saw during the offseason. So I think really what it became with Baker is fatigue. Like, all right, we'll handle this if it's Patrick Mahomes, but what are we doing here? Like, why am I at an empty First Energy Stadium with Baker Mayfield? Like, why do I care? So I think that's why. And Baker is not really going to change, or at least he says he's not going to change, but he kind of has. I do think he's not talking as much because I think that there were a lot of lessons to be learned from that first season with Odell, with Freddie Kitchens. That was an epic disappointment. And I kind of feel like, oddly enough, that season stung more than – nothing stung more than the winless season. Not necessarily 0-16 because that was really embarrassing, especially the way that it happened to the Steelers towards the end. I think we all were kind of like resigned to the fact we were going to go winless, and then you had a chance to win that game and you drop the pass, and you're just like, God damn it, it's incompetent as ever. But, yeah, I kind of – that one hurt me more than like the one-win season. Yep. I guess, because of the expectations. We don't do a lot of carrying expectations in the seasons here as Browns fans, and we did there, and it burned us. So I do think there's a little bit of PTSD there from Baker. He's a little more coy when he approaches the media. I saw him chime in on the match yesterday when Tom Brady and Aaron Rodgers are the fact that he's in that company, right? Wouldn't it be cool that some producers – saying, wouldn't it be cool if we have Baker Mayfield being interviewed while Aaron Rodgers and Tom Brady are on the golf course? He has this big superstar quality, but he doesn't necessarily have the success associated with the big superstar quarterback just yet. We're all kind of projecting it with Baker. So I think that's why they keep moving the goalposts. And by the way, that's not a bad place to be. They move the goalposts on Aaron Rodgers to this day.
That's true. I personally think that, yeah, Baker did get some flack for being in the commercials for, like, coming out swinging on what's-his-name show?
Coward
Show.
Yeah.
But I swear, I think that he owes everything to that mentality and what's brought him the success he has in Cleveland. I mean, you have to have a chip on your shoulder. You are trying to turn around a 1-15 team that followed that up with 0-16 team and just kind of say, bring it on. And people don't talk about how he's gone through 30 different head coaches in 2.5 years. And yeah, he definitely did kind of draw the lines, setting up that us against the world mentality. But I think it's the mentality he has to have. He was a walk-on at Texas Tech, walk-on at Oklahoma. And who knows? I'm just like, I agree that he has kind of humbled himself a little bit within the media. I don't know if that's just being tired of going to battle every time or whatever, but
Raleigh, I think he was a young man still. And I think
he just turned 26.
Yeah. I think he was a young man, and there were things that I was doing at 23 that I stopped doing at 26. And I think overall, there's just been a maturation from how he approaches social media to the public image that he and his wife have now together. I think there's just been an overall growth and development of Baker Mayfield, the person, and thank God. And I think this carries over to just nutrition. I think his body's in better shape now.
I think his body's
in better shape than it was 2 years ago. I think he learned a lot of harsh lessons that, okay, at Oklahoma, I could just trot onto this field and my dynamic arm would be enough, and I could be brash and I could be cocky and I could be pulling at my groin. This is the elite. Everyone made it through something. Everyone has their own way of how they got to the upper echelon, to the pinnacle of the sport. So you're going to have to put in the work. And I think he realized that, and it just goes to the overall growth and maturation of Baker Mayfield, the person, and I think the Browns will benefit from that.
Greatest Nicolas Cage movie of all time, and why is it The Rock?
I don't think it's The Rock. The Rock's certainly a top three film part. Now, The Rock's incredible, but if to tap into a Nicolas Cage list, you have to go Maximum Cage, right? And The Rock was more Maximum Connery than Maximum Cage. In retrospect, it was a more subdued Nicolas Cage. And I don't think a subdued Nicolas Cage benefits anybody. So while it's a great action flick, the premise is unreal. I actually went to Alcatraz a couple of weeks ago, and I was just reciting lines from the film and explaining the plot of the movie to my wife's 18-year-old cousin. We were really not touring the most infamous prison in America's history. What we were touring was the set of Nicolas Cage's third greatest film. And I really enjoyed that. But for me, it's Face Off, because he runs the emotional gamut there. And it's not too crazy, because now Nicolas Cage finds himself in the zone where he really turns it on and he hams it up because he knows what it is around him. It was like, I kind of liken it to Christopher Walken. At a certain point, Christopher Walken sees onto all the things that the imitators were doing, and it's almost like he started doing it more, and it kind of diluted the pure cut of Christopher Walken that made him so cherished. So Face Off, because he had to play two characters, and it's just a banging action movie, and the fact that Travolta is almost as good as Cage is in that film, and come on, the premise, they switch faces. He gets stuck as Sean Archer gets stuck as Caster Troy, and Nicolas Cage has to emote this when he sees his wife as the person that killed their son. I mean, can you imagine?
It's insane. I haven't stopped thinking about this since you said you went to Alcatraz. Did you just recite the entire Navy SEAL ex renegade Marine shower shootout scene?
We saw the showers from afar, but I was too busy trying to explain to my wife's 18-year-old cousin, who in the heady play is a parent, I decided, hey, you want to come out to California? And then I trick her into watching my kid at night. So I did that, and I explained the nature of the chemical weapons and how, you know, they're going to try to lie to you and tell you that no one ever successfully escaped Alcatraz. No one successfully escaped The Rock, but there was one man.
Sean Connery.
Yeah. And yeah. They're the only crew crazy enough to actually try to break in. He spent his entire life trying to break out. Now, just when he thought he was out, they're pulling him back in for a break in. So really, it was just the construct of The Rock and how Nicolas Cage dove towards the rolling ball of chemical disease that was headed its way across the bay. to San Francisco and how we owe our American livelihood to Nicolas Cage and Sean Connery on that one faithful afternoon day in the mid-90s.
Having the courage to fight after the top SEAL team in the country was tragically gunned down by those renegade Marines. Like, and they still had the courage to go on. There's a lot of life lessons there.
Yeah. And the dichotomy of thanking the heroes and the villains for their service because they were disenfranchised. It was really just a minefield.
Yeah. There's a lot of humanity in General Hummel's approach to everything, but I mean, that's just life, man.
When you watch it through the prism of 2021, Raleigh, you kind of understand where Ed Harris is getting at, but you also understand that he acted way too far.
They all had shipmates that were down in the mud, shit on by the Pentagon, and man, I am jacked up after this interview.
Sorry to get off the movie train. One more question, Mike. You started with the Dan Le Batard Show when you were 19, I believe.
Yeah.
As an intern.
Mm-hmm.
You've been there ever since. That was 2005. Am I correct again?
Yeah.
Nice. 2 for 2. We're getting better.
It feels like a deposition at this point.
That's coming after we get off the mic. No. Again, you guys have one of the most successful, most listened to, downloaded podcasts in the world. When I've been asked, you know, how do you think a podcast gets so successful? Obviously, I don't have any experience with the best podcast in the world to say anything. But my opinion is that consistency is what makes podcasts get to where they are. It's not people that come out and expect their first episode to get 1 million downloads, and if they don't, they're a failure. People that just keep going and going and going and going and building and building and building. You have seen every side of this business more than most people on the planet. What would you say is, if you had to pick one thing that would make for a successful show, podcast, can't even put your finger on just one thing?
Well, for us, the thing that made us most successful, I think, was prioritizing it early on. So if you're a podcast today, that train has come and gone. Back in the days where having an RSS feed was a very confusing process and it would take you 12 minutes on iTunes to download, like, we were ahead of that. Our radio station wanted to kill our podcast because it was cannibalizing our radio numbers very early on in the process, and I wouldn't let them do it. And we found ways to continue that. And actually, our RSS feed that we have to this day is the very first RSS feed that we had. And that's not something that you hear in this industry a lot. Yeah. Through several negotiations, we always kept it. And in this most recent buyout with ESPN, I still prioritize it. And ESPN let us have it. And
I'm trying to wrap my head around this.
It's the very same RSS feed that I was uploading as a teenager.
Wow.
Well, if you ever get bored with the Le Batard Show and you want to develop a Brown-specific podcast empire, we are always on the prowl for another intern. keep that in your back pocket.
Kevin, to answer your question for the contemporary podcaster, I've found that, yes, consistency is massive because you don't ever want your listenership to break the habit of listening. It's why, yeah, you don't have spots in June and July, but you're still out here in the drier months where it's harder to do Browns content because you feel you owe your listeners that. Before you can grow the base, you have to prove that you can maintain your base. So shout out to you for putting in the work. And I think right now, presently, the biggest way to grow your digital audio product is by going on other digital audio products, by talking to other podcasters. I feel like there are some podcasts that do a very great job. Link in the bio. Check out it if you want to check out the podcast. If you want to check out the Dan Le Batard Show, check out the link in this bio. I think that's the best way to grow it. And now digital video is really one of the marketplaces that I feel like even the Le Batard Show has been a little late on, and we're trying to play a little catch up. And I'm really excited about the metrics. Freedom was a large part of really developing the digital video asset because I want that to sort of catch up to the digital audio product, and the digital audio product is obviously a behemoth. So digital video is, I think, the next great frontier for content creators. It's why we're on a video platform right now doing this podcast. That's the next best way to grow your content. You have to be multifaceted, digital audio, digital video, and the lines have to be blurred to the consumers to what's prioritized. They both have to share equal importance. That's how you grow.
Yeah, Raleigh and I were going to do a Patreon and just have our video like a shirtless podcast for those that pay. So,
we're going to sell feet pics.
We keep feet.
Mike, this was incredible, and I appreciate. You know, I had a lot of personal producing questions I wanted to ask, so I appreciate you taking those. I don't have to plug the Dan Le Batard Show. Everyone here knows what Dan Le Batard Show is, but we will, of course, have all the info in the description for anyone that's been living under a rock. It's okay. We don't blame you. Raleigh, any closing thoughts or words? Do we want to ask Mike for his record prediction? Or are we going to jinx something?
Yeah, I think we got to hold off on that until we start seeing.
At least August?
Yeah, at least August. Mike, thanks so much for taking the time. We've been trying to get you on for a while. Not to steal your bit, but talk to you tomorrow.
Talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, Mike. Much appreciated.
See you guys. It was a pleasure.
Slinging the ball around, oh yeah, it's Tim Couch. That man is jacked, and that's a fact. Hell of a quarterback, oh yeah, it's Tim Couch. Listen up, everybody knows this is how the story goes.